found a way to tell the same story with greater brevity. After all, my home office in the White House sat right next to the Lincoln bedroom, where a signed copy of the 272-word Gettysburg Address rests beneath a glass case. But each time I sat down to write, whether it was to describe the early phases of my campaign, or my administration's handling of the financial crisis, or negotiations with the Russians on nuclear arms control, or the forces that led to the Arab Spring, I found my mind resisting a simple linear narrative. Often, I felt obliged to provide context for the decisions I and others had made, and I didn't want to relegate that background to footnotes or endnotes. I hate footnotes and endnotes. I discovered that I couldn't always explain my motivations just by referencing reams of economic data or recalling an exhaustive Oval Office briefing, for they'd been shaped by a conversation I'd had with a stranger on the campaign trail, a visit to a military hospital, or a childhood lesson I'd received years earlier from my mother. Repeatedly, my memories would toss up seemingly incidental details, trying to find a discreet location to grab an evening smoke, my staff and I having a laugh while playing cards aboard Air Force One, that captured, in a way the public record never could, my lived experience during the 8 years I spent in the White House. Beyond the struggle to put words on a page, what I didn't fully anticipate was the way events would unfold during the 3.5 years after that last flight on Air Force One. As I sit here, the country remains in the grips of a global pandemic and the accompanying economic crisis, with more than 178,000 Americans dead, businesses shuttered, and millions of people out of work. Across the nation, people from all walks of life have poured into the streets to protest the deaths of unarmed black men and women at the hands of the police. Perhaps most troubling of all, our democracy seems to be teetering on the brink of crisis, a crisis rooted in a fundamental contest between two opposing visions of what America is and what it should be, a crisis that has left the body politic divided, angry, and mistrustful, and has allowed for an ongoing breach of institutional norms, procedural safeguards, and the adherence to basic facts that both Republicans and Democrats once took for granted. This contest is not new, of course. In many ways, it has defined the American experience. It's embedded in founding documents that could simultaneously proclaim all men equal and yet count a slave as 3/5 of a man. It finds expression in our earliest court opinions, as when the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court bluntly explains to Native Americans that their tribe's rights to convey property aren't enforceable since the Court of the Conqueror has no capacity to recognize the just claims of the conquered. It's a contest that's been fought on the fields of Gettysburg and Appomattox, but also in the halls of Congress, on a bridge in Selma, across the vineyards of California, and down the streets of New York, a contest fought by soldiers, but more often by union organizers, suffragists, Pullman porters, student leaders, waves of immigrants, and LGBTQ activists, armed with nothing more than picket signs, pamphlets, or a pair of marching shoes. At the heart of this long-running battle is a simple question. Do we care to match the reality of America to its ideals? If so, do we really believe that our notions of self-government and individual freedom, equality of opportunity, and equality before the law apply to everybody? Or are we instead committed, in practice if not in statute, to reserving those things for a privileged few? I recognize that there are those who believe that it's time to discard the myth, that an examination of America's past and an even cursory glance at today's headlines show that this nation's ideals have always been secondary to conquest and subjugation, a racial caste system, and rapacious capitalism, and that to pretend otherwise is to be complicit in a game that was rigged from the start. And I confess that there have been times during the course of writing this book, as I've reflected on my presidency and all that's happened since, when I've had to ask myself whether I was too tempered in speaking the truth as I saw it, too cautious in either word or deed, convinced as I was that by appealing to what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature, I stood a greater chance of leading us.